Today is February 6, 2020. We are at the National Park Service offices here in Nome. I'm Leslie McCartney. We have the pleasure of being with Vera Metcalf this afternoon and with Katie Cullen. And I'll let you both introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Katie Cullen. I'm the Interpretation and Education Program Manager at Bering Lambridge National Preserve in Nome, Alaska.
And Vera?
Well, my name is Vera Kingy-Cook-Metcalf, born and raised in Savonga, and I'm the director for the Eskimo Walrus Commission at Kirinome.
Right. So can we just talk a little bit about your parents and growing up in Savonga?
Right. My parents were Theodore and May Kingy-Cook, who raised 10 of us. I have 5 brothers and 5 sisters. We come from a large extended family. My father was well known for his taking long walks and hiking and jogging, and my mother was amazing, resourceful, wonderful woman to raise 10 of us plus 2 of cousins who lost their parents at an early age. So I grew up with a big, big family.
Yeah.
Kingy-Cooks and Galagwigans are extended from 2 brothers. So.
Okay. Where are you in the 10?
I was the youngest, but in our society, my brother had the last baby, and the mom, my sister-in-law, got sick, so naturally we wanted to take care of the baby, so we didn't want to give her back. We adopted her, too, so technically I'm the youngest, but...
She's the youngest.
Yeah. Mary was the youngest.
What was it like growing up in Savonga?
Growing up in Savonga, you know, we're organized into clan systems out on St. Lawrence Island. My family comes from the Kewaumee clan, which is Kewa is a point in Chukotka, so we have lots of kinship in Chukotka in Russia. Mm-hmm. And growing up in Savonga, you have to go to school in the fall time, but in the summer, we spent a lot of my time at our camp, our summer camp, gathering greens, roots, birds, fishing, wood, cutting wood to, you know, subsistence lifestyle. But also we had challenges of having to, you know, go out to look for food and come home and there's, you know, don't have any, so you have to resort to other resources that were available for us. So there were challenges, but for me, growing up in a small community like Savonga was wonderful experience for me. My parents grounded us very well, foundationally, into knowing who we were and where we came from. Identity on St. Lawrence Island is very strong.
Yeah. And we were just talking, you were saying that the pastor who married you is 103 now, and that she had come to Savonga when she was 20, so the church played a large role in your life?
Yes, Savonga and Gamble, it's that time when Sheldon Jackson, yeah. I don't know if you remember, Presbyterian came, and you know, supposedly we were divided into send the missionaries to Savonga, Presbyterians, or Barrow. Mm-hmm. And Alice Green came when she was 24, 25 years old, and first woman, I believe, within the that time to minister. And I know that she probably baptized many of our family members and so many of us, and married, and of course, you know, we had to have memorial services for folks that passed on. But she was a strong supporter of our marriage, because my father did not want me to marry anyone outside the community, so he was resistant, and Alice made sure that we did everything cultural, correct, and the protocols. We had to honor that system where my father was an old, you know, she called him the old believer, and we wanted to respect his concern for me being the youngest to marry someone not from the community. Island.
And what year was that then?
We met 76 and we got married in 79.
Yeah. Now, did you go to school the whole time on the island?
Yep, I went to school, grade school up to 12th grade, and mm-hmm. then I went, graduated 8th, and then I spent a boarding school here in Nome.
Oh, so the high school was in Nome then, was it?
Yeah. So 9 to 12, I was here.
Right.
And then college, I was I'm a graduate of University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Mm, very good. So what did you graduate with from
Rural studies, yep. community research, and cultural documentation was my interest.
Wonderful. And did you go back to do any cultural documentation?
I have, yeah. I've done some work through University of Alaska Fairbanks Museum with repatriation prior to where I'm at now. And we call knowledge repatriation was bringing back documents to St. Lawrence Island of people that were taken by the 1920s, mm-hmm. 30s, and trying to identify,
right.
working with the elders of who these people were.
That must be really
way
exciting.
Beyond my time. So.
Yeah, exciting work.
It was exciting work, but also interesting because I learned so much about my history, mm-hmm. my background, who I was based on that repatriation work, and working with the elders really increased and strengthened my identity as being someone from St. Lawrence Island, Yupik.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then plus it gives you the museum far more knowledge about what documents or artifacts they actually have, more cultural context for those things.
Yeah. They were historical documents, and I think it was a pride. I know it is a pride for people from the island because they... I couldn't say that so-and-so is my relative in this book, and these people are long gone, but we work with the elders that we had back in the, were maybe in their 50s, 60s, but it was hard for them to remember who these people were back then, so.
Right. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very rewarding.
Very rewarding
for me.
Yeah. So then how did you and your husband came to Nome to live?
Right. He, living in a small community has limited opportunities for finding a good mm-hmm. paying job. So I worked as a teacher. I was a bilingual teacher in Savonga. But we moved here because he found a job that he could, work at and help get an income.
Right.
It was kind of hard to leave home because my father was still resisting mm-hmm. us moving. Being the youngest, I was there to help take care of him. But we moved and he worked in an airline and hospital. And,
right. And has your dad since passed away?
Oh, yeah. He passed away years ago.
Yeah.
But he was in his 90s.
Right. That must have been really rewarding, too, though, teaching your language.
Yeah. I still speak, read, and write it fluently. So I do, which is great asset to have because I can translate. Not a long technical documents, but...
But some. So do you find that there is a lot of translation work for you?
I do some translating work for the court system sometimes for clients who need some... help in understanding the legal terms of, mm-hmm. which is a challenge also because, you're trying to find the Yupik word for beyond a reasonable doubt or what does that mean?
Right.
So,
yeah.
I like that, but I also trying to find alternative meaning in Yupik is you have to work at it.
Yeah.
And make sure that your client understood
what the concept of the
yeah
and the context of the word actually means,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, very interesting. So you work at Quirik right now mm-hmm. too, and how long have you been there, Vera?
I started at the Eskimo Heritage Program, learning more about my background because there's a lot of resources over there interviews from our people from the island in Nupiaq that were our house there. So that was very, again, a rewarding experience, just listening to people that have passed on about what their thoughts and wishes and dreams were for preserving Yupik language.
Yeah. And where are those recordings housed now?
At the Eskimo Heritage Program.
Are they?
Here at Quirk.
Quirk. Very interesting. Yeah. Have they all been digitized?
I think that's what they're working on.
Okay.
We started that.
We can talk about that later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I moved to the Eskimo Wallace Commission in 2002, and we have a co-management agreement with a federal agency, Fish and Wildlife Service, to co-manage a shared resource Pacific walrus population with US and Russia.
Oh, interesting. So how does that all work then? That must be very complicated.
We don't have a bilateral agreement with Russia, but my work is to make sure that the resource is available as part of our food security, and it's harvested sustainably. And it'll be available for, if they're healthy population. Our federal partners are more into numbers, counting, and that's fine, but we're more concerned about the health of the population because it's part of our food.
Right. And so I would imagine then you get a lot of community input.
Right. We have 19 coastal communities that are part of the Eskimo Walrus Commission. And we do, we do communicate with the other marine mammal commissions in Alaska, whaling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the same people that are walrus hunters can also be whaling captains. So
right.
It's, you can't pick and choose.
Right.
Yeah.
So have you encountered changes in the walrus?
I think right now the population is very healthy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good number. We like the number that Fish and Wildlife Service determined at, a certain, I can't remember, 213,000 animals, give and take between 50,000 to 500,000 or whatever. So it's an estimate. But my concern is because of changes in the environment, we hear of our hunters going further to find good ice to harvest, because harvesting a huge animal like walrus on ice is safer than having to butcher it in water. So ice is further. Accessibility can be a challenge because, out in Savunga, the walrus might be available, but it's bad ice, you can't get to it, so accessibility can be one of the issues that we deal with, and availability. We know that the population is healthy, but it's access. You have to get it at the right time, right weather conditions. It's not an 8-to-5 job.
So, right.
Yeah. And we're hearing more and more of our hunters traveling further to find game, and that's a safety concern to us.
So game meaning walrus and other game?
Yeah.
And traveling further as in traveling further along the coast or
further
inland?
Out.
Further
yeah.
out
yeah.
to try and find it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, if a seal, bearded seal is available, they'll resort to that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe sometimes the walrus will be closer. It's easier when it's closer because gasoline is very expensive, getting your gear mobilized can be very expensive for a small community. Many of the hunters carve and make income out of those types of resources. So it is a very expensive, but that doesn't stop them going out.
What about the stories we hear on the radio sometimes about, you know, huge landings of walrus coming into certain
haulouts?
Yeah.
That is occurring more. And, for example, at Point Lay, there's been a large number of walrus hauling out. So we work with the community and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to make sure that commercial pilots and vessels are aware of the haulouts when they're there to avoid have a certain altitude when they're flying over or divert or vessels stay off the shore 30, 50 miles out.
So as not to bother them as much?
It might cause just stampede.
Right.
And calves can get trampled.
Right. And then also, too, in the last few years on the radio, they've been talking about because of the lack of ice, the walrus are having to go further out for their food.
Well, walrus are smart.
Yeah.
I mean, they can haul out on land and haul out on ice. And we've been told that they can also give birth in the water.
Oh, wow.
And that's they're adapting to the changes.
Wow, that's interesting.
And the way I know is one of our elders in Savunga said, we know that because when walruses give birth on ice, their umbilical cords are shorter, but when we see long ones, we know that they have given birth in the water.
So, interesting.
And they're smart, smart animals.
Adapting well to,
adapting to
things, Interesting. What are some of the current issues then for the Walrus Commission?
Well, for us, we do have researchers interested in collecting samples to assess the health of the population. What are they feeding? Is their food resource diminishing because of ice supposedly helps, you know, clams are available. You know, we're worried about ocean acidification, of course, and harmful algal blooms, all these issues that will affect, you know, because walruses are benthic feeders, whatever they feed on the bottom will eventually affect the food resource for us. But clams are also, we it's part of our food resource. So any changes in the environment that we want to make sure that the health, the environment is healthy because that's a sign that our communities are going to be healthy too.
Right. And you were at the same talk that we were at the same talk together last night about where you were talking about the clams and different toxicities in the clams. And had you must have been aware of all that research going on.
We know of those researchers. We've worked with them before. So it's good information for us because not a scientist or a biologist. I'm just making sure that communities have access to these resources and it's harvested in a non-wasteful manner.
Right.
It's available.
Yeah. And that the food that is being harvested isn't full of toxic materials.
Right.
Which is really important that they were talking about last night at the talk. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting.
So we like researchers, and we try to work with our communities to collect biological samples as long as they're compensated for the work that they're providing to the science.
Right.
It's just not free anymore.
Right.
And we fought over the years to have people paid for providing samples that are critical for understanding science, but we also encourage our, you know, researchers to work with our hunters because they have a unique understanding of the environment that is not often taken into consideration.
Yeah. You said there was 19 different communities, Vera. Can you name some of those communities?
Well, all the way from Utreyarvik down to Bristol Bay. So.
Oh, way down there. That's a huge piece of...
Bristol Bay area has, they have a walrus haulout Round Island, which is managed by the state of Alaska. So we work with quite a few of their hunters, ensure that it's a different system down there. But
Yeah. So any differences are you seeing in walrus between the north part of the Bering Sea and the south part of the Bering Sea?
I think that's a good question for our hunters, because they always seem to know. Are they more bulls down there, or females? And,
or size distribution, or...
Yeah, distribution of change. Are they changing?
Interesting. And so you meet as a commission how many times a year?
We used to meet twice a year, but because of federal budget cuts, we only have one annual meeting. So we're working on getting other funding resources to increase our meetings. But, you know, foundations, any kind of funding, have their own terms and regulations. We can't.
Right.
Funding is it's always big issue.
Big issue, right. And what are you hoping to do in future with the commission?
Well, I am trying to get more and more of our young people involved in understanding the rules and regulations of what it takes to manage a resource like walrus. So I have some funding to hold a young hunter summit here in Nome for our region, and then the rest of the communities will be... hoping to have hunters that are between 18 and 29 involved in management discussions. What does it take? What does the Marine Mammal Protection Act? What is it? How does that affect you as a young hunter? What is Endangered Species Act? All these rules and regulations that I have to deal with every day to understand it. These young men need to start learning, and not only that, but the international laws that could help us in advocate for the work that we do. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be holding a young hunter summit here in Nome.
What are some of the common misconceptions then with hunters to what you say the regulations are? Is there any misconceptions or
no? We're always message is to, you know, hunt responsibly. We do have walrus harvest guidelines, promoting non-wasteful take. Any violations against MMPA is something that we promote and advocate for to, you know, hunt responsibly. And, you know, media can play a big part in sending the wrong message, and next thing you know, you have environmental groups going after you. So just having to be careful of sending out the right messages.
Yeah.
Important.
Do you work any part with Russian counterparts?
We do have Russian colleagues that we work with. In fact, I'm just trying to wrap up a National Park Service project to collect indigenous knowledge from hunters over there on their observations and knowledge of walrus and the challenges that they face.
Yeah, are they similar challenges to it?
Pretty similar, but you know, their system is much more different than what we have here, so we try to support them in any way we can.
And the traditional knowledge, did you find it similar?
Similar, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, St. Lawrence Island, we have spoken over there, so we have a lot in common.
Yes.
Family, friendships, and friends and relatives.
Very good. So it's interesting that you said that you're giving workshops, and that's more about the rules and regulations, I suppose, correct?
Well, we'll be bringing in someone like Gay Sheffield to share her work, and we'll have someone that is well knowledgeable about international laws, and like UNDRIP or United Nations, laws that affect all kinds of hunting, or what, just so the young men can begin to know and maybe become the next commissioner or have their own young hunters.
And is I take it though that the traditional knowledge between generations is still being transmitted to the young
people? That's the other thing that I'm starting to see is changing, and you know, we're going to have some of our five or six of our elder commissioners involved, mm-hmm. so they can share their knowledge of what it takes to be a hunter. Yeah.
So you said you're seeing a change there. What is the change?
Just maybe terms in Yupik. We have a lot of, a walrus is just not a walrus to someone living in, there's bull walrus, female in water, calf on mom's back. I mean, there's, that's those things that I think the young people need to know more, and what are the rules and the right protocols to harvest animals. I mean, there's spirituality involved, and I think that needs to be emphasized, that you just don't harvest an animal just to harvest it, but
everything that goes around with it.
Yeah.
And you know, so that's not being maybe transmitted as much as it was before?
Well, I think it is, but it's going to be interesting what kinds of information. It's going to be, not just me talking, but I want to hear what they want to see in the future, mm-hmm. you know. What is it? What are your research interests? What do you want to do? Are you interested in becoming a biologist or... Mm-hmm. What are your dreams and aspirations of being a young hunter?
Yeah.
What can you share with others that may benefit from?
Yes, go ahead. Have a drink. Are you okay, Katie?
Yeah, my apologies.
No problem. So when are you hoping to have those workshops then, Vera?
Well, we just sent out the application. We're leaving it out for the tribal organizations to help complete the forms, and my first one, hopefully within this region, will be early spring. I'm looking for facilitators to do the work, and the other one will be with the remaining communities, and then the final one will be to bring everybody in.
Right.
To what do we do next?
Right, next steps forward. Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely.
Yeah, I already have some interest from Greenland. But I said I just want to start small and see where this leads.
Yeah, start with your own region first.
Yeah.
That's interesting that Greenland's also interested.
Well, I serve on the Inuit Circumpolar Council of Alaska. And I'm on the executive committee, so we do a lot of dialogue with Greenland, Canada, and Chukotka.
So what issues are right now with the Inuit?
We have an office here in Alaska, and we're getting ready for our next General Assembly, which will be in Ilulissat, Greenland, in 2022. Mm-hmm. So we're getting ready to... we have a declaration that we're trying to follow some of the initiatives, mm-hmm. and food security, food sovereignty is that I'm focusing on, and there's of course health and
right.
education, language, culture.
I think all of those issues are quite broad in the whole circumpolar area.
Oh yeah,
and they've always been dealt with by that commission for years.
Yeah,
That's interesting. Yes, council. How long have you been on that council then?
I got on in 2010.
Really?
Yeah,
and it meets
every
4 years.
4 years.
Yes,
but we our chair is from Alaska. And she'll be involved in our summit because she's very knowledgeable about international laws and regulation. She's a lawyer too, so that helps.
Yes, very much so, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be wonderful to be able to go to Greenland and meet all those people.
Well, I've been to Greenland a number of times, but they want to see if they can send in some of their young people to a summit, but I have to figure out, maybe to the final one.
Yeah, yeah. So you were saying you've lived in Nome since the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
You must have seen some changes in the environment and things here just in that period of time, or have you?
Yeah, I think so. Later ice forming. We live in icy view, so there's less, we ski, and there's hardly any snow at this time of the year.
Yeah.
Hard pack right now, a lot of shoveling.
Yes.
Windy.
More so than it used to be?
Yeah, more so it seems to be.
In different directions too?
Yeah, different directions. Oh my God, it just changes. You know, it's from the north next, and because I love to walk, and I rather walk when the wind's behind my back, but it's just shifting.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not too familiar with Nome, but we have a camp down Cape Nome, which the erosion has been, it's not, you know, creating hazard to our campsite, but the beach. Now I think the sand's coming back, which will elevate the...
Mm. So was the sand washed out then at one time?
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I don't see as much driftwood as I used to. I don't know, because we use driftwood for
fire.
Fire.
Yeah, interesting. How long did you camp there then?
We rent from, you know, the village corporation, because we're not a member of the regional corporation, but I can't remember when it was built. But to get away from the busy Nome life, where there's no electricity, and no, just the beach and the quiet and the campfire.
And we go there in the summertime as well, so you do fish there?
We used to, it was meant to be a fish camp, but that's because fish closures, we don't really fish anymore, but we still have fish racks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So the sand all washed out, and now it seems to be coming back.
I think it's coming back. Yeah.
Interesting.
We haven't been there. I think the roads are closed right now, but in the summers, that's where we go. In fall time, it's good for picking berries.
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
As long as the bears are not around, you have to be able to look out for bears.
Yeah.
Do they come close?
They come along the beach.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. We've had musk ox
too.
Yeah, so I think they like the salty grass or something. But it's beautiful. I mean, it's a nice little place for us to go to
get away from everything. Katie, just doing this for you.
I was wondering a little bit about the co-management system, and has that been in place? I guess I'm not too familiar with kind of the history of how it was set in place, and how long has it been in that setup?
Well, the Walrus Commission was formed in 1978, and I believe the Marine Mammal Protection Act was passed in 1994, and I may miss some of my dates, but in it they also created what they call the Section 119, which allowed funding to be available to organizations like Eskimo Walrus Commission. And it's, the species are split between National Marine Fisheries Services and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services manages polar bears, walrus, and sea otters, and NIMFS, National Marine Fisheries, manages bowheads, sea ice seals, and belugas, I believe. So, split between two federal agencies. And I think the funding came in when Senator Stevens was around. He really pushed to have adequate funding for co-management activities. But since he passed away, it's been kind of... what is that funding that people always complained about? I don't know. But he fought to have funding available for marine mammal commissions. The two of my mentors were from Savoga that ran the Eskimo Walrus Commission. It was Matthew Aya and Caleb Pungawi.
Oh, Caleb.
Yeah. And they were, you know, they fought and at the office maintained, and they did a lot of advocacy, and you know, I always appreciate their leadership qualities to have the Walrus Commission as it is, you know, it still exists. So.
And is the Whaling Commission also a similar, like the same structure as the co-man, like it's co-management as well?
Yes, they have their own commission members.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I believe there's 10 from our region, and their office is in Barrow.
Mm.
And they have a chair. In fact, they're meeting this week. But their funding comes from National Marine Fisheries.
Ah, okay.
And they have a lawyer, and we don't. But that's, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think Lerslope is different because of the oil.
Money.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I'm curious to learn more about it, about co-management in general. And I haven't had a chance to learn much about it yet. So
We work with our co-management partner, the Fish and Wildlife Service, who in the past have used to be challenging because of different leadership, but I think we're coming to an agreement where we have similar research needs, and we're starting to talk more, and that has improved over time. Mm-hmm. And I always appreciate people that have worked before, Matthew, Caleb, and Charlie Johnson,
mm-hmm.
and others who fought to their battles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's different system, same people, same
mm-hmm.
hunters, yeah. Just change hats when they want to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was talking with Gay this morning. She was saying about just to go back to that Samanga last year didn't even get a whale.
Right.
So there's been changes in that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what's going on, but we're hoping that the spring will be a better whaling season.
Yeah.
And for, of course, walrus hunting.
Yes.
And in the summers, they have, Savuga has a CDQ program, Community
mm-hmm.
Development
mm-hmm.
Quota Program through Norton Sound Economic Development
mm-hmm.
Corporation, where they can harvest halibut for subsistence and commercial. So it's a good system, and
mm-hmm.
it seems to be good working because it helps with bringing in income,
yes.
Income. But those guys just hunted 15-foot skiffs and go fishing and
wow.
Determined to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. So I think Gamble got whales last year, though.
I think Gamble
got whales. Mm-hmm. So there's still a lot of community sharing between
yeah,
the communities.
Lots of sharing.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful.
Right.
Yeah.
Especially if one community doesn't get anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So quite a few people then in Sabungar are participating in the halibut fishing for subsistence?
Well, there's whoever can afford
could
have the gear. And the,
right.
It's long line.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't have huge vessels to go.
And then, Gay, do you have to go at a certain time today?
As long as I get to my office by before 2:30.
Okay, well, we'll wrap up then quickly. But Gay was also mentioning about the commercial fishing boats that had actually gone up further into the North Bering Sea last summer. Did you know about
right.
that?
Right, we're always worried about commercial trawlers, fisheries, because
yeah.
their gear might get lost and entangle
yeah.
into entanglement issues.
So can the Walrus Commission take a stand on that or do anything?
We have,
uh-huh.
With the help of people who are oceanographers like Jackie,
mm-hmm.
who have helped us write letters to fisheries, large fishing, but you know, you wouldn't be disturbing this environment.
Yeah.
Walruses are going to be hauling out there.
Right. Yeah.
Critical habitat for, I think you heard the eider.
Yes, they were talking about the eider ducks
mm-hmm.
yeah, last night too. Oh.
Yes, yeah, so we use resources like Gay and other researchers who know more about the benthic stuff.
That, yes.
For advocating for us.
Right, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've got to go. We don't want you to be late. Did you have anything else that you wanted to tell us that perhaps we haven't covered?
I don't know. I think I am looking forward to this Young Hunters Summit. It's a lot of work, but it's needed. I often hear of Young Fishermen's Summit, so why not do a Young Hunters one? And it's been creating a lot of interest. Mm-hmm. I'm excited about seeing what we're doing, what the next generation can bring to the table, yeah. And the new young folks.
That's right, yeah. I hope it's really successful for
you. I hope so, too.
Yeah. Katie, did you have anything really else, too? Exciting. Yeah.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Vera.
I was just thinking, gosh, if there's any way we can... Is there any way we can help support the summit or we'd love to.
Corey just posted more information on
that's
it.
That's exciting,
so see what happens. I hopefully we'll get a steering committee together and identify facilitators who are knowledgeable about mm-hmm. the work that we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and get the elders involved too.
Involved, yep.
Definitely. Well, okay. Good luck, Vera.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in today and sharing everything with us. Yep, thank you.